This is an interview with Terry Pritchard for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is October 31st, 2013, and we're in Washington, D.C. So thanks very much for talking with us today. We usually start with a little bit of personal background. I saw a nice profile of you, actually, on Securities Law 360, I think, that went into a little bit of that. But maybe you wouldn't mind repeating a little bit of, you know, what you said there. I guess your father was a lawyer, and that got you interested in being a lawyer yourself?
My father was a lawyer. My brother is a lawyer, so it's definitely a lawyer family. We used to joke that my mother was the judge. But, yeah, I went to Bryn Mawr College, frankly, was it one of those stages where I wasn't sure what I should do next and decided by default as much as anything else to go to law school and went to Boston College Law School and actually began my career in-house at what was then the First National Bank of Boston and spent 4 years there. They have a rotation for new lawyers and really did a lot of work in-house, and after the two-year rotation I was assigned to litigation, which I did for a couple of years. They did a lot of litigation in-house at that point. And then my husband, who received a PhD in philosophy, received a teaching position offer at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and since philosophy is a lot more difficult in terms of marketing and finding a position than law is, I agreed to look for a job in Washington and actually was interested in one of two jobs, either the antitrust division or the enforcement division of the SEC.
Okay. What sort of cases were you working on at the bank?
You know, typical commercial litigation kinds of cases, but I had become very interested in the security side during the corporate rotation. So to me, the notion of putting together securities work and litigation work in the context of enforcement was really appealing.
Okay.
Or antitrust work. I was happy to go in either direction, although at that point in time, the enforcement division was much more active than the antitrust division was, so it had a particular appeal.
Yes, we're coming into a period in the 1980s. I guess, just put some dates on things. You got your AB, it says, here in 1975.
Right.
And then your JD in 1978.
Right.
And then you came to the SEC in 1982.
Right.
Which is indeed the beginning of a very interesting period for enforcement at the SEC.
That's right. Insider trading was a very hot topic at the time, and the enforcement division was really in the early stages of freezing assets of U.S. branches of foreign banks or U.S. Citizens with accounts in foreign banks. So there were a lot of Swiss bank account cases that were making the headlines and things like that. I actually was in a branch early on where our branch chief didn't love the insider trading cases. So, the two cases I remember being first involved with, one was a loan loss reserve case out of a bank in Texas, and we didn't bring that case. Yeah, and the other was actually the Bayswater case, and that's a Carl Icahn entity that we sued for being an unregistered investment company. So I was actually not in the middle of the intense insider trading cases in my first couple of years there.
So why was it that they wouldn't want to be, or they wouldn't be excited about pursuing insider trading cases at that time?
My branch chief?
Yes, your branch chief.
You know, I think he just loved the more technical cases, the accounting cases and the manipulation cases and kind of the more, I'll call them the more numbers-oriented cases. So, you get assigned to a branch and you get assigned cases and that's what you pursue. And they were great, too. Mm-hmm. It certainly rounded out the program. But certainly the headlines of the time were the exciting insider trading cases.
Yeah, John Shadd had made a point of going after those cases by that point already. Is that correct?
I think that's right. And John Fetters and clearly they hit upon something because there were a lot of big cases that were brought in those years, really, in the insider trading arena.
Well, this is definitely something we're going to be wanting to talk about a lot. So before we get into that, into the depths of it, why don't we discuss a little bit coming up through law school. As I was saying before, this is as part of a series on women in regulation. So could you tell me a little bit about your experiences, what the proportions of women were in the environments that you were in, what the experience was like?
You know, well, I went to an all-women's college, so you know, it's hard for me to obviously talk about that. But at Boston College Law School, by the time I got there, interestingly enough, there were a pretty significant number of women. I'm going to say, I doubt it was 50%, but we weren't a dramatic minority. There were certainly lots of us around, probably 30 to 40% back then, women. So it wasn't an uncomfortable situation at all. I think the educational environment was much more progressive in terms of welcoming women into their ranks than it took a bit longer for private industry and government, I think. But
Can I ask what it was about Bryn Mawr in particular that sent you there?
I don't remember in particular other than my very conservative religious parents thought that an all-women's college would be a good choice.
Right.
And actually scratched their heads a lot about why on earth I would want to go to law school, because, you know, they didn't have a perspective that women would want to have a profession, and certainly not that women would want to both have children and have a profession. I mean, that was just not in their realm of things they would conceive as, you know, desirable for their children.
Mm-hmm. So. And not to dwell on the subject too much, but you mentioned in your profile, too, that judges could sometimes, at that point in time, be a little bit condescending.
Oh, I have a laundry list of funny stories about the early years, whether it's judges or, frankly, secretaries in New York law firms. You know, they're just very funny. They're funny now. I don't think they were so funny at the time. but certainly, yeah, judges who would, you know, comment on your looks as opposed to the substance of what you were saying and things like that. So, yeah.
But on the whole, you were saying the SEC was a pretty comfortable environment.
Yeah, it was. Now, you know, in enforcement, the SEC overall was a great place for women, I'm sure. You've probably talked to lots of the, lots of the stars, Linda Feinberg, Elise Walter, the late Linda Quinn was wonderful. In enforcement, there were far fewer women. So, you know, I was actually a pretty early, supervisor. Debbie Hechinger was before me, and I think that's it in terms of women in supervisory roles in enforcement. Alexia Morrison came in at about the same time, I think, as me in the trial unit. So she kind of was the other person who was a senior woman in enforcement.
Okay. Why don't we talk a little bit about the breadth of the cases then you would see when you came in? And you said at first insider trading was not the central thing that you did. So maybe we should do a survey.
Well, I mean, I think my cases in my years there probably covered the gamut of all insider trading, of all securities laws. Mm-hmm. You know, it was everything from a 40 Act case to a lot of accounting cases. I actually like the accounting cases. I don't think I did any FCPA cases back then, manipulation. By 1984, that's when I became a branch chief. The year after that, I spent a lot of time on the E.F. Hutton check kiting matter, which was a criminal case and an SEC case. And then really by 1986, that's when I was promoted to assistant director and became in charge of the branches that had just nabbed Dennis Levine. So I would say from that point to the end of my career was primarily focused on Ivan Boesky, Michael Milken, and the Drexel-related cases.
So what role, when you first got there, were you playing? Was it mainly an investigation, litigation?
Right. Okay. Yeah, staff attorney in the enforcement division doing investigations.
Okay.
Which I loved. And, you know, that's an amazing role in which to learn so much, because you really, you have to do it all. And certainly back then, there was bureaucracy, but less. So, you know, you would subpoena documents, review documents, find the smoking guns, figure out what you needed to do with them, take the testimony, pull together the information, and present it to your supervisors. So, a great role.
Okay. You worked with a couple different directors of enforcement in your time there.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about them?
John Fetters was the first director of enforcement. And, you know, amazingly, given that I was just a staff attorney, although he is the guy who promoted me to branch chief, I did get to know him. And, you know, he was very interested in the cases and the people he had in his division. You know, I can say this, he promoted me when I was 6 months pregnant. And that was a leap of faith back then. And when I came back, it was really John Fetters. I wanted to work 4 days a week but keep my branch chief job, and he decided to give it a try. And actually, we joke, because for the next 5 quarters, my branch brought more cases than any other branches, and the joke became, what would happen if we cut her back to 3 days a week? So, you know, he was interested in the work. He was supportive. You know, I can say this about the commission generally. Everybody always wanted to do the right thing. Politics were really not a part of it at all. I certainly knew what John's politics were. Mm-hmm. But whether it was John Fetters or John Shadd, they were very intent on doing the right thing, based on the information we gathered and analyzing whether there was a violation of the securities laws or not, and pursuing it if there was. So that's what I would say about John. Gary, you know, Gary was the same in that sense. Gary and I spent a lot of time together because, of course, you know, the Drexel case,
yes,
and the Marty Siegel case in particular, was really the first, probably, of the Ivan Boesky spinoffs that we pursued. You know, he was very personally involved in those. So, that was a great experience for me, and I would say the same thing about him that I said about John. They were intent on being supportive and helping us do what we could to figure out the actual facts and then do the right thing by the facts.
So the branches that you're a part of, I guess it's sort of a technical bureaucratic question, did they have particular responsibilities?
Not in the early years. So when I was a branch chief, my my branch did everything. So we had lots of, by then we had insider trading cases, accounting cases, manipulation cases, offering cases, all kinds of different cases. And there were 6 or 7 lawyers in that branch who pursued those. When I became an assistant director, as I said, by then Dennis Levine was just beginning to cooperate. So we were just beginning to get information from him. And as it evolved, there was one branch of my 2 branches that became completely devoted to pursuing Drexel deals. So there were a lot of deals involved in the Drexel case, and they were really divided by lawyer. Lawyers would be assigned to investigate a couple of the deals. And so an entire branch was devoted to Drexel.
Okay. I guess we better start talking then about these cases in particular. So you said you arrived just as Dennis Levine was beginning to cooperate?
I was promoted to assistant director,
right,
over those branches just as he was beginning. He had cut a deal, yes, and we were obtaining information from him in his cooperation mode, and pursuing the other members of, there were a group of people sharing information, and we were pursuing the other parties to that.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about the process of the investigation?
The the investigation into Dennis Levine was pretty much over by then. You know, the history is that there was suspicious trading observed by Merrill Lynch. They sent it to, I assume, Gary Lynch, someone in enforcement. We began to pursue Bank Loy, which appeared to be the hub of where the profits were going. They were a Bahamian bank. They would not provide information. Ultimately, we put out a border watch, and someone from Bank Loy came to the U.S. and was served a subpoena, I think, at the Waldorf Astoria, at which point the difficulties contesting jurisdiction became worse for Bank Loy, and they began to provide some information, although not the identity of the owner of the account.
Right.
So ultimately, what happened was we had some very good people working on the case who kind of put the puzzle pieces together and really focused on Dennis Levine. And ultimately, we were able to establish that it was Mr. Levine who was the owner of the account. He did some resisting. There were asset freezes filed in that case. And really, as I said, I came in when all of that was done. By the time I got there, he was talking, and we put the cases together against the other members of his ring. And, of course, one of the people he identified as a source of information was Ivan Bosky. And really, my focus at that point became the Bosky case. And then, you know, what I would say is the information that Mr. Levine provided was pretty limited. But there was a long history of tender offers and you know, we had trading records. We got them by hand in those days on things called blue sheets. But we could see patterns of Mr. Bosky trading in advance of tender offers. And we kind of did an analysis of which deals he was hitting on in an effort to figure out who might be his other sources of information. By then, based on what we heard from Mr. Levine, we were quite convinced he had other sources of information. So some of it was a guessing game. And ultimately, you know, I think our guesses were close enough and hit frequently enough that Mr. Bosky believed that he too had to come in and cooperate.
So. Okay. I guess you were dealing with these people personally. Could you tell me a little bit about what they were like to deal with, Levine and Bosky?
Well, Levine I didn't actually deal with all that much, so I don't have a good sense of him. And Bosky, I went to a few sessions after he was cooperating, but I'll tell you, my primary role was really to take the information he was providing us and figure out what to do next. In terms of my impressions of Mr. Bosky, I would say I saw, I'll call them two personalities. There was the Ivan Bosky that was the public face previously, and some days he had that face on and he was confident and in control, and other days or nights, because we were doing this at night, he was more introspective and reflective, and so he was a very interesting guy.
So tell me about where this goes next then.
Well, we took the information. You know, I remember well there was a meeting in Boston that Gary Lynch and John Stirk and I went to, and Ivan Bosky's lawyers came to, in which they basically told us that he could provide us with information that might change our perspective of how Wall Street really worked. And of course, ultimately, he provided us a lot of information about Marty Siegel, and that case was brought, and Bosky and Milken, and there was a Jeffries piece, and there was an Ivan Bosky Gulf and Western piece. So there were a variety of, I'll say, buckets of of information that we wanted to pursue. And really, for the few months while we were talking to Mr. Boesky, we were getting organized to issue subpoenas at the time that we announced the Boesky matter. So the Boesky matter was kept under wraps, I'm going to say, for 2 to 3 months while we debriefed him and prepared for the next steps. And as you may know, we filed that case on a Friday after the close of the market because we were worried about the market impact of announcing the Boesky case. And at the same time, we had enforcement lawyers from my group deployed across the country to serve subpoenas as the announcement came out. So that took a lot of coordination, figuring out who we would serve, what we would ask for, and how we would orchestrate it. And I would say that was the bulk of my 2 months, was receiving the information, figuring out what to do with it, and orchestrating that.
Were there any debates on the strategies to be taken? I know that you have to, in dealing with some of the earlier figures like Levine and Boesky, to get to the further figures, there, you have to, I guess, cut deals, so to speak.
I would say during that phase, we weren't cutting deals.
Right.
We were absorbing information from Boesky and figuring out how to proceed. There were certainly a lot of discussions about how to proceed. You know, is it appropriate to delay for 2 months? Boesky had positions. What about those positions?
Yeah.
What happens to them? So there were all kinds of strategic conversations happening during that period of time. There were not deals being cut with other people because our desire was to learn what we could, get subpoenas out to preserve documents, and then pursue deals. Really, the deals began right after that happened.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about some of the, I guess, international aspects? I know that there was a lot of dealings early on, maybe even before you got there, with the Swiss banks and the Swiss government. And then, of course, you're dealing with the Bahamas in the case of Levine and Bank Loy. And I know that Michael Mann is the real expert on this, but perhaps you could give me a little insight.
You know, I don't have a lot of insight because I wasn't directly involved in those cases. I obviously know that the pursuit of the Swiss banks led to an MOU with Switzerland, which Michael was deeply involved in, and ultimately became the model for MOUs with other countries as well. And it was a huge breakthrough for the SEC. And frankly, to this day, the asset freezes that were done by the SEC, I think, are I still look back at them and think about how we did that with the limited amount of information we had. We didn't even know who the traders were. So I think that was a great coup for the SEC, but I really can't shed a lot of light on it because I wasn't terribly involved in it.
Okay. And also, as you were pursuing cases, there was also a changing legal environment with a series of Supreme Court cases. It had begun back in 1980, I understand, but then, of course, there's the Insider Trading and Securities Fraud Enforcement Act. How did that affect enforcement?
Well, I would go back. There was the Insider Trading Sanctions Act, which, of course, imposed sanctions that went beyond give us back your money. And I would say that's the first big step, because suddenly it wasn't, the risk-reward balance changed at that point. And after that, it was, frankly, further changing the risk-reward balance. So that was very significant and made those cases more fun to pursue, frankly, as a prosecutor. And the other thing that was happening was the law was expanding. So there's the traditional insider trading where an insider breaches a duty to his or her corporation by providing information or trading on information. And the trick really was to get beyond that to circumstances where the breach of duty was not just to the corporation itself, but could be to... There could be another breach of duty which could form the basis for insider trading, and that's the misappropriation theory. So that was just being developed at the time as well. So those, I would say both the increase in sanctions and the development of the law made those things very exciting to pursue at the time.
So it's the technicalities of developing a case for misappropriation that makes it fun, would you say?
Well, you know, all insider trading cases are fun because it's about putting the puzzle pieces together. You know, you start with a blue sheet, and it tells you who traded when. And you're, of course, looking primarily at the 2 days or the 3 days before a tender offer is announced. And you're seeing a huge spike in volume and in price, and you know they knew something. And so then it's, you know, where did they live? Who did they know? Right? And it really is like putting a puzzle together. And those are fun. When you find that last piece and you finally see the puzzle and you figure it out, you know, that's an exciting moment for a prosecutor. So, you know, for me, I was really more in the trenches back then, putting those puzzle pieces together, or, you know, later on having people bring to me the puzzle pieces so that we could look at the picture together.
And when you were associate director, what percentage would you say of your time was spent on these big cases?
Assistant. You know, 90% of my time was spent on Drexel,
yeah.
And Ivan Boesky. Had another branch, maybe 80%. Maybe I'm exaggerated. I did have another branch that was doing other cases, and I'm sure they felt neglected because it was hard to find the time, because the focus was so much on Drexel and Boesky and the information Boesky had given us in following up. And, you know, the Drexel case was a battle for a lot of years. So.
And what were your dealings with the U.S. attorney's offices? Did you personally liaise with them?
I spent a lot of time first working with Charlie Carberry, who... was an amazing guy. In fact, I remember the first time I went to a meeting with Charlie, he was unhappy with one of the players in the Dennis Levine ring who had worn a wire, and I don't remember the details, perhaps had warned the other side that he would have a wire on or had messed up the conversation or something, and Charlie Carberry was quite angry, and you know, I was quite impressed with his confrontation of the witness, and frankly, I thought he was scary, so I can only imagine how the witness felt. So.
Okay.
And then after that, John Carroll came in, and really John Carroll was the head of the fraud section during the Drexel and Boesky, during the Drexel case. Charlie did the Boesky case, and he too was very diligent, and they were great to work with. We worked very closely with them throughout the whole process.
Now, I know your career moves over to the S&L crisis after this. So what, if anything, did what you were doing then have to do with what you would go over to do?
Well, they were both enforcement, and they were both in the, you know, in the greater financial services industry, but they come from very different perspectives. So, you know, the securities perspective is about disclosure. The securities laws are about disclosure. The banking laws are about the safety and soundness of the financial institution, and sometimes that's the antithesis of disclosure, because you don't want to run on the banks, or you don't want to publicize whatever may be wrong. So I would say from those perspectives, very different philosophies about the reasons for bringing the cases that you're bringing and the reasons for the law. But the S&L crisis, you know, was in full swing when I moved over, and the prior director of enforcement at the OTS really was criticized a great deal in the Wall Street Journal. So it was not a happy time when I arrived at that agency. And, you know, pulling that staff back together and getting focused on some of the big cases they had going on was really my mission then. And you know, we did some good cases there, too.
Yeah, I want to ask about some of the mechanics of that and the particulars. But could you tell me first the circumstances surrounding your move over there?
to the Office of Thrift Supervision, I should know.
Yeah. You know, Rosemary Stewart had resigned, and so that was an opportunity that was open. I had been an assistant director for a few years at the SEC, and I thought it was a good opportunity to really kind of shape an enforcement program. So,
Who are the people who are doing the, I guess, recruiting for that position?
Harris Weinstein was the general counsel at OTS at the time, and he was the primary recruiter. And Tim Ryan was running that agency. So I think they were the two people who made the decision.
Okay. And your title was deputy, I've seen a couple versions, deputy chief counsel or deputy general counsel of enforcement?
Good question. I wish I could tell you I remember. I think it's the former deputy chief counsel, but I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. So now tell me a little bit more in detail about some of the work, I guess.
Well, you know, that was a circumstance where, as you know, the back then we thought that was a financial crisis. There were many failed savings and loans. There were many bad loans that had been made by savings and loans. There were often land flips involved and other fraudulent activities. So in the banking world, there was both the fraud piece and a much more active, what I'll call, regulatory violation side of things. We had enforcement people throughout the country. My Washington group really was much more focused on the fraud, the bigger fraud cases. It wasn't all that different from the SEC. You know, you gather information, you analyze it, you take depositions, and then you file claims. Now, by then, we had, you know, interesting, I'll call them asset freeze types of provisions in the banking laws. So in many ways, it was very similar. You know, the case that I remember being most focused on at the time was Beverly Hills Savings and Loan. And a guy named Tom Spiegel. And, of course, I remember that because I, you know, did the bulk of the arguments in California on the asset freeze and things like that. Very similar processes and, you know, from my perspective, focus on the big frauds.
Okay. And then ultimately move over for a year to the Resolution Trust Company. Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, that was a really fun job.
Yeah.
Again, I'd say the RTC had filed a couple of hundred cases against directors and officers of failed thrifts, and they were losing just about all of them in court. So it was a mess. Everybody was very demoralized, and a couple of people from the OTS went over to take over the RTC and asked me to come over and co-manage the D&O liability program. And so, you know, as you can imagine, you arrive, and there are 200 cases, and they basically say, figure out what to do with these. So it was a lot of high-level conversations about why are we in this case, what do we want to get out of it, do they have the assets to pay, did they really do something wrong, let's pursue it, let's not pursue it, I'm going to fly down and try to cut a deal on that case. So it was just a wonderful year where you know, I could, again, dive into the cases that I thought were significant, you know, direct that we wrap up cases that I thought weren't significant, and really feel like we could make some progress in wrapping up what was lingering, you know, for the S&L crisis.
Was it about the same level of engagement with the details of the cases themselves at the SEC as in these other positions?
Yes, at the OTS, but not at the RTC. At the RTC, we used outside counsel to pursue cases, and so, you know, they would prepare memos for me as often as anything, and I would read a 50-page memo, and then we would have a half-a-day meeting on the case and the pros and the cons of pursuing it and the strengths and the weaknesses, and so I was much more involved in the strategic calls. Unless I decided to go and try to negotiate a deal. I did not go into court when I was at the RTC. I really left that to the outside counsel, but I was very involved in what to pursue, what not to pursue, what to argue, what not to argue, you know, why are we losing these cases? Let's take a look at the argument that was made in that case and figure out how we can refine it so that we can do better, those kinds of things.
In attempting to reform, I guess, in the wake of the troubles that the Resolution Trust Company and the Office of Thrift Supervision had had, was it primarily a matter of increasing the diligence on the cases, or were there strategic issues involved that had to be improved?
Well, at the OTS, I don't think there were strategic issues. That was fundamentally looking at the case, figuring out if there were violations, building the case as the investigators at the SEC did, and then bringing the case if it was appropriate to bring it. At the RTC, of course, it was different because it wasn't, we're talking about receiverships, we're talking about failed thrifts and litigation that gets brought against the directors and officers in an effort to recover funds for the receivership. So very different context. I would say more, one has to behave more like a plaintiff's lawyer in that circumstance as opposed to an enforcer. I always believe that the enforcement role really involved trying to figure out what was right and wrong. You know, did somebody do something wrong? Is it appropriate for the government to pursue them? And then what's fair and what's not fair? You know, the big matter when I was at the OTS involved freezing the assets of a law firm, Kay Scholer. We had a lot of internal discussions about whether that was an appropriate thing to do or not. And frankly, I fell on the side of, I don't believe that people should be deprived of the ability to defend themselves. And if you freeze somebody's assets so that there's nothing left, you know, they have no choice but to settle with you. I viewed that as not particularly appropriate behavior for an enforcement division. The role of the RTC was really much more, as I said, classic litigation, classic commercial litigation. I am the receiver. I might be able to collect some funds for my receivership from the directors and officers who made the decisions that led to the failure of the thrift. It didn't have to be fraud. It could be gross negligence standards, things like that. So I would say that was very different, and there were more strategic classic litigation decisions in the RTC role than I perceive that there should be in the enforcement roles. Those roles, to me, were more about what's right and what's wrong. We've accused somebody of something. They have the right to defend themselves.
It's interesting, the, contrast between, on the one hand, you have the power of government behind you when you're in an enforcement role. On the other hand, a lot of the people that you're going after are extremely wealthy and powerful individuals. You clearly feel, both sides of that equation of the power imbalance. On the one hand, you don't have many resources. On the other hand, you do have that statutory authority. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, I would say that what I would say is that certainly in both contexts, we went after many very wealthy people. Drexel, Milken, Boesky, they had the power to defend themselves, and they had the assets to defend themselves, and that was okay with me. The banking statutes were designed to enable asset freezes, Again, we went after many very wealthy people, and that was fine. As I said earlier, it was my belief that people had a right to defend themselves from our allegations. And so while I thought we needed to freeze assets in the event that we needed to recover those assets, I also thought that there should be accommodations for people to defend themselves in a circumstance where it's a law firm. And not an individual. You know, we're not talking about whether those assets are going to disappear from this country. We're talking about in my mind, whether we want to deprive them, whether we want to get leverage over them. And so that, to me, is the distinction. Are the assets going to disappear? And so I have to impose an asset freeze in order to preserve the potential recovery that I want to get. Or are they going to stay here anyway? And so really all I'm doing is putting pressure on them so they can't defend themselves. And that was the distinction for me. Does that answer your question?
I think so. It seems that it's kind of a case-by-case issue where you feel different balances of who has the leverage in a particular situation.
And I think you have to look at them on a case-by-case basis. In my mind, asset freezes are entirely appropriate, as I said. If you're worried about the dissipation of those assets or the transfer of those assets to a place where you can't recover them.
Yeah. I probably should have asked about piggybacking on insider trading a little bit earlier when we were still at the SEC. But could you tell me a little bit about that, kind of trying to extend cases out to that level? I know it could be problematic sometimes.
Are you talking about to tippies and remote tippies?
Yes, exactly.
Ultimately, we did a fair amount of that. And I think we did extend the reach of the insider trading laws further and further, if you will, to remote tippies. I don't know really what to say about that other than it's more of putting the puzzle pieces together and following the leads and seeing where they take you. And at some point, the distance between the remote tippie and the original tip gets attenuated enough that you really can't and perhaps shouldn't pursue it. And it led to some case law, which I would say you needed to really establish a link a little more firmly. But, I don't have a great deal of memory about being too deeply involved in those cases.
Okay.
I was so absorbed in Drexel
the really
by then
ones.
That,
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Well, you were involved then with quite a few things that were very high profile in the media constantly. Could you tell me a little bit about that, what the experience of that is like, I suppose, whether you felt it impacted you in any way?
The media, certainly the day after Boesky, I remember going to the office with my then 2-year-old and seeing a picture of us in the New York Times that Monday morning, myself, John Stirk, and my 2-year-old. Sometimes that was fun. But frankly, the media, it was interesting to watch the media evolve in the Boesky situation and the Milken situation, because sometimes stories took on the life of their own and we would read things in the newspaper that we knew not to be accurate. So that was always fascinating. The media scared me a bit. I was never a big fan of talking to the media, regardless of which of these roles I was in. And that probably continues to this day. I prefer to keep my head down and do what I think is right and let them pass judgment separately.
Did you feel pressure, say, from Congress or anyone else because of the profile of these cases?
I certainly was involved in, more often than not, in the background, but Gary Lynch had to testify several times and certainly was involved in strategy sessions about those. And, I know our desire was that they leave us alone and let us figure out, in fact, what the facts were, and let us decide what we thought was the right thing to do. But they have a role, too, and their oversight role, they pushed us. But I think for the most part, even there, we felt that we got to the right place at the end. So
the directors provided a nice bulwark, then, between that world and your world, essentially.
Right. So, I was, as I said, behind the scenes having strategy discussions, but Gary Lynch was the one who really had to deal with that. So
right.
I remember one or two meetings on the Hill, not even sure they were related to Boesky and Milken, where, I was on the firing line with the staff of some congressmen, but but really Gary took the bulk of the pain in that.
Right.
Returning to the theme of women and regulation, in your dealings with this Wall Street world, did you ever feel that your status as a woman played any role in your dealings with it?
Not really, no.
No.
I think I felt just taken seriously and like one of the team. I did, have two children
yes.
during this period of time. So that certainly created some interesting dynamics. I remember sitting in one meeting. It actually might have been with the Drexel folks. Having somebody ask me when I was due and saying 2 days ago, which caused a little nervousness at the table. That was interesting. But again, I never felt that I wasn't taken seriously or treated like, a legitimate team member.
Yeah. Even by the people who you were in enforcement actions against, I suppose you didn't have that much dealing with them. But.
Well, I can tell funny stories about little incidents along the way from people I was deposing when I was a staff lawyer or otherwise, who would... And I would say to you, in the training program at the SEC, because we had for new SEC lawyers a kind of a deposition-taking training program, I would always stop and say, here's a message for the women in the audience. There are men who are just not going to take you that seriously and who are going to think you don't get what they're talking about. Go with it, because at the end of the day, it's whether you win or lose that counts here. And if they, and I used an example of a man who was saying something to me, and I said, I don't understand, and he said, that's because you don't understand business. And I said, okay, you might be right, please explain it to me. And he, basically admitted to a violation of the securities laws. So, my attitude was, that's fine. If that's the attitude they want to have, use it. So there were some, I would say, messaging to women. There were certainly efforts by people I was deposing or lawyers on the other side in some matters to, if you will, play a superior role because I was a young woman. But at the end of the day, I don't think that occurred in the bigger cases we've been talking about, I don't think it was a real issue among my colleagues at the SEC.
Were there any mentorship roles that you played or that people played for you, whether as a woman or not, that spring to mind?
Mentoring wasn't as big back then as it is now, and Debbie Heckinger and Alexia Morrison were the women who were older than me in the division, and I guess what I would say to you is we had jobs and we had babies and we did not have a lot of time to be having lunch and discussing what it was like to try to get balance in our lives. There was no balance in our lives, and that was just a given. I don't know how else to say it. And frankly, I was probably less focused on mentoring then than I should have been. I was focused on, as I used to say, it's just too much of too many good things. There's not enough time in the day. As my career evolved, I became more focused on trying to be a mentor. What I would say is I had many good bosses from whom I learned many things. There is not one person who I kind of viewed as a mentor, including at the SEC. John Stirk was a great boss from whom I learned a lot. Paul Fisher. There were a lot of good people from whom I learned a lot and who were supportive, but there's not one person I would point to as a mentor.
Okay. So now getting back to what I was saying before, is there anything that we've missed? I know we went very quickly over the later stages of the insider trading scandal, so we didn't talk a lot about Michael Milken or Marty Siegel, but I don't know if there's anything additional that we wanted to say about this period before we talk about the transition to private practice.
You know, I... They were the bulk of my career in my mind the SEC. Marty Siegel was a guy who came to us after the Boesky case was announced and cooperated and had a fascinating story, which really was one of the more colorful stories about exchanging briefcases full of money in the lobby of the Plaza Hotel and code words, red light, green light, and things like that. So that was a very sexy case, I guess, is how I would describe it. And Gary Lynch was very involved in negotiating that, and Judge Rakoff was representing Marty Siegel at the time. So that was quite a fascinating experience and a learning experience for me to watch how that played out. Drexel and Milken, I would say that was the David and Goliath situation. And, Drexel and Milken had armies of lawyers. And we had our little team, and it was a great team, and it was bigger than any other team at the SEC, but relative to Drexel and Boesky, we were a small team. They were electronic. We started to get some computerization and things like that in the middle of that case. Until then, we had been doing it all by hand. So, those were fascinating times in terms of the development of getting computer systems at the SEC and trying to figure out how to run these bigger cases in a way that would enable us to compete with armies of lawyers on Wall Street. So I guess those are the two things I would add about those cases.
It's actually kind of fascinating how computerization could help at that early phase of things in handling a case of that size. I mean, is it mainly... I know that the blue sheets were all manually done at the time. Was it mainly in terms of that, or was it to document handling? Or
I'll tell you a funny story. I remember getting a call. I can't remember who it was from. Somebody in New York on the Drexel team, and they wanted a CD of the transcript of someone whose testimony we had taken. And I was instantly suspicious. Why would they want a CD? They must want to manipulate the information. Well, no, they had some system where they could search it for information they were looking at for. I went to the front office and I said, did you know there are machines that can do this? I mean, we were still cataloging documents by hand. We probably had over 1 million documents at that point, and they had systems in place. So, as I recall it, it really was the beginning of trying to begin to use electronic systems in investigations.
Okay. So then should we move on to your transition out of the government regulatory world? So tell me a little bit about that, I guess.
I went to the RTC after spending some time at the OTS, and the RTC was scheduled to close in 18 months. And I think 3 months after I got to the RTC, Gibson Dunn approached me and said, what are you going to do when your agency closes? My recollection is that I basically said I need to stay here a year because it wouldn't be appropriate for me to have taken this job and then just walk out. But then a year after I went to the RTC, I went to Gibson Dunn. I found the transition alarmingly easy, I guess. I'm fond of saying, I guess it's just that everybody was guilty in the 80s and innocent in the 90s, because I really didn't have a lot of trouble. It's kind of like, maybe I'm just a robot. Tell me what side I'm on, and I'm comfortable there. I worked with John Sterk at Gibson Dunn, again, who I'd worked with at the SEC, and with John Olson, as well as Chuck Muckenfuss on the banking side. So, again, they had defense strength in the two areas that I had been a regulator in, or an enforcement lawyer in, and it was just a wonderful springboard for me to begin to work on their cases and then develop a practice of my own and a reputation of my own. Did a lot of speaking. I did a lot of speaking, both in the banking agencies and after I came out. And again, you know, it was really their support that enabled me to start to develop my own practice.
Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about the evolution of cases with them? I mean, I know there's a changing legal environment, technological environment we were just talking about, but I don't know, what stuck out to you?
At Gibson Dunn?
Well, I mean, Gibson Dunn at Bryan Cave.
You know, what sticks out to me is, I guess the difference between private practice and government, of course, is that you have to both obtain the work and then do the work. And when you're in the government, you don't have to spend a lot of time obtaining the work. It seems to just appear. And so it's a combination of learning those skills and also, you know, learning how to work on the defense side. And I would say I have had some wonderful, wonderful cases along the way. Wonderful in terms of interesting, not necessarily in terms of, you say wonderful cases. One of them, I guess the most significant case I've done in private practice, is a case called Learnout and House B Speech Products, which was a Belgian company with a $9 billion market cap listed on the NASDAQ. And basically turned out to be a massive fraud. And I was counseled to learn out, and it was before Enron, so it was around 2000. And, you know, the process of realizing that I had a client that was engaged in very bad behavior and figuring out what I was supposed to do in this pre-Enron world is probably, in my mind, the most significant matter I've kind of had to deal with. You know, I would spend a lot of time talking to my PhD in philosophy husband about who's my client, right? And what are my obligations if I believe my client is engaged in fraud? Is my client management? Is my client the board? Is my client the shareholders? And until I could resolve that, it was hard for me to figure out what to do. And as I said, this is pre-Enron, so there wasn't really a roadmap. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I decided my client, despite the fact that the people who hired me were management, I represented the company, and that was the shareholders, and the board were the representatives of the shareholders. And ultimately, I went to the audit committee and the board, and laid out what I believed had been going on, and we ultimately did an internal investigation and disclosed the major problems that existed in the company. Frankly, filed for bankruptcy 10 days later. Hmm. So, was a huge case. Spun off an SEC investigation, tons and tons of litigation, criminal. I think 30 people were indicted in Belgium. So, and it had all the international aspects that complicated things a great deal. You know, it had an auditor that had KPMG as an auditor, but KPMG Belgium, and so there were a lot of issues about audit work papers and whether they were Belgian or U.S. and who could access what. And so that was a great case in which I really had to kind of make sure I was comfortable that on the defense side, I still had a responsibility to expose what was obviously a very bad situation.
Yeah, how often is it that you're essentially dealing with an SEC investigation, and how often is it that it's sort of more of a post-crisis situation wherein you just have to help clients to resolve whatever it is that has happened internally at their companies?
Well, I would say it's not often the latter. It's either an SEC investigation, or more and more often now, it's a concern that comes from compliance or somewhere like that, that's particularly an FCPA space, that triggers an internal investigation. And so it's almost like going back to the SEC. You know, it's conduct an investigation for us, figure out what the facts are, come back and report to the board and tell us what to do. So that's a major part of my practice now, that and SEC defense work.
Internal investigations?
Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting. So I'm not necessarily interested in interfirm politics or anything, but you're at Gibson Dunn from 95 to 99, and then you came here to Bryan Cave in 99. You can talk about that transition if you like, or if not, you know, I mean...
Well, there was a guy at Bryan Cave named Jerry Bowles. He was the former head of the Los Angeles Regional Office of the SEC, and he was getting older and looking to retire. And so they were looking for somebody to take over the Securities Enforcement and Litigation Practice Group, which was national. And that sounded like a great opportunity to me. So I had actually worked across the table from Jerry Bowles and had great respect for him. So I thought it'd be a wonderful opportunity. And that really is what led me to Bryan Cave. I came, and within a few months, as was agreed to in advance, I became the head of the Securities Enforcement Practice. So it was a combination of doing the work and bringing in the work and doing some management stuff.
Okay.
That was appealing.
And so you've been out of the SEC and the OTS, the Resolution Trust Company, now for less than 20 years. So,
but not a lot less.
Not a lot less. Looking back on it, how much do you feel that still affects, I guess to be philosophical, your identity today and the skill set that you bring to your private practice?
You know, I can tell you anytime an associate asks me if they should spend time in the government, I tell them I would never trade that experience for anything. I think the skills that you develop, the relationships you form, the reputation that you get, really, they all happen there. And as I said, I wouldn't trade any of that for the world. It was such an exciting time. And, you know, as you move up in the government, you really do have other people look for the smoking guns and bring them to you, and it's exciting all the time. And I don't have the longest attention span. So jobs like the RTC, where I'm spending a little bit of time on many, many cases at a very high level, are really fun. So I wouldn't trade any of it for the world. And certainly all those investigative skills that I learned as a young lawyer at the SEC, I use them today in my internal investigations. So I think it was a wonderful experience.
What about the volume of cases from place to place that you've been? I mean, you were working on a few very high-profile cases at the SEC. I wasn't quite clear on how many you had in your subsequent positions, and then here, of course, in private practice.
Right. And at the OTS and the RTC, the volume of cases was much higher because I was at a higher level. So I had more people under me working more cases. And I can't even put numbers on them, but at the RTC, I'm going to say there were a few hundred cases. At the OTS, there were probably fewer than that, but certainly plenty of cases that, lots more than at the SEC. And private practice, you know, like everything else, it varies dramatically, but it's much more like going back to being a staff lawyer or a senior counsel, in the sense that certainly I, and I believe most people, get more deeply involved in a few cases. It's not like we have 50 cases here that are active at the SEC that I'm supervising. It's much more that, you know, I have a handful of cases that I'm deeply involved in.
So that had to be part of the appeal of coming back or coming into private practice.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
You know, the deal with a bunch of cases at a high level is very appealing,
yeah,
too. To tell you the truth, I've loved it all. So I you know, as I probably get to the last stages of my career, I think they've all been great experiences. So,
well, that seems as good a place as any to wrap it up, unless you have something else you'd like to add.
No, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.